Accession number 30639, Mr. Alan Davis, Reel 5. Now, we're talking about when you were attending Flying Tiger Moths and Grading School at Carlisle, November 43. And we talked about the circuits and bumps and your instructor. Now, was there anything else that happened before your first solo that you recall from there?
Well, perhaps I should elaborate a bit more on this instructor. He was a flight sergeant, and I regret I don't remember his name. But he was very patient, very tolerant, and extremely good instructor, because he had 10 hours to assess whether we were fit to take this tiger moth up on our own, and he had 10 hours of instruction to do it in. In other words, if you didn't go solo in 10 hours, you were unlikely to progress any further. And I'm happy to say that I. And my immediate buddy, we both soloed in about 7.5 hours, which I think is a fairly average, standard sort of time.
Now, do you remember your first solo? Because some people do, some people don't.
Yes, I do. But it was apart from feeling very proud of myself and cocky, the danger was to become too cocky and overconfident. I think that was taught by this flight sergeant as well. To have regard to the pitfalls and dangers of doing things wrongly. So I had this solo. You have perhaps a series of circuits and bumps first, and then, if you like, the instructor gets out of the front cockpit and says, "There you are. You're on your own." Or was it the other way around? He was in the back cockpit, we were in the front. I honestly can't remember.
I think you swap over for the solo. What do you remember of it? Anything at all? Or
well, the only thing I can remember is carefully doing this circuit, which had been drummed into us, and then coming into land, making sure that you were truly into wind, and realising that I was coming in over some hangars, which... I'd never come in that particular way before, because I don't remember seeing the hangars that close, and I remember being very conscious of these great big aeroplane hangars looming up very, very close underneath me. And then I remember making a landing which was as good as any I had done, which was very, very pleasing. It really sat down very happily on the ground, doing just what I had been taught to do. But the sense of achievement of having actually broken through that first solo barrier, hurdle, if you like, was absolutely tremendous. And my friend, a chap called Jeff Hill, he and I both soloed in the same sort of week or so. I can't remember which of us went first, but the competition for being able to go solo was quite great. Because, as you've already gathered, one or two people didn't go solo, and they probably weren't fit for flying as a pilot, and we never saw them again. So that was grading school. And
now, did you do any flying after that, there?
Oh, yes. Well, we went on to flying every day for the rest of the period that we were there, and till we achieved this magic 10 hours. So more or less everybody got 10 hours worth of actual flight time. So that was grading school, and happily
now there was an incident with that you were telling me just off tape. Tell us a bit the background to that.
The background to it was, when we first got to Carlisle, we got lectured at by a corporal or a sergeant on how to behave. For example, not to shoot a line in the town about flying, because they'd heard it all before, things you could do, things you couldn't do. And I think it was this particular station where the corporal said, "And when the CO addresses you and he looks down and barks at you, where'd you come from? He doesn't want to know the town you were born in. He wants to know what RAF station you were in before you came here. He's not interested in your domestic life." And he also said that discipline guard duties were very rigorous on this airfield because two German POWs had pinched a plane, a Tiger Moth or Magister or whatever it was, that they jumped into, and they flew it down to the south coast and nearly got across to the other side, but they ran out of petrol, and the RAF weren't terribly concerned because they knew they wouldn't have enough petrol to get over the channel, but the danger was that if we weren't very careful, POWs would do this sort of thing, pinch an aircraft right under your nose and fly it away, so to be on our guard. And I subsequently, some many, many years later, found an article in a chapter in a book which explained in great detail how these Germans came to get away with doing that. They had kidded everybody they were Dutch airmen, because we had quite a lot of foreign airmen in strange, not British uniforms, who were also pupils at the grading school. So it was not uncommon to see these strange-looking, strangely attired pilots mooching around the place. So it was not it would not have been unusual for the two of them to have climbed into an aeroplane and supposedly taxied it or taken off in it. So they didn't get away, and everybody was happy. But it's a most interesting story.
Now, so what, you were just there, what, in November 43?
Yeah.
Did it go on any longer than that?
No. I think we left in the month of November sometime, and then we were told that because he hadn't done an initial training wing, ITW, we had been a university air squadron, we were all to go on a special discipline course at Cambridge, and we were again put on a train in a great squad of us, about 100 of us, and taken to Cambridge, where we had to endure this month-long, another month, discipline course. Lots of drill, lots of button polishing.
And this was just, what was it known as at Cambridge?
Well, Cambridge was an initial training wing, an ITW, and this was just known as a DISIP course, where people who hadn't gone through the normal ITW routine got this little extra bit of drilling and rifle
drill. How did you take to the...
Well, it was just a stepping stone, and being fit and very keen and eager, and we lapped it up, really, because we got pretty well pushed around pretty hard for the first week or so. But when the corporal, I remember he was called Corporal Ireland, when he realised that we were a willing lot of volunteers and not an unwilling squad of not very well disciplined pupils, he laid off the pressure. The pressure was reduced, and we had a much simpler time, but we still had to do most things at the double, and I remember kit inspections and that sort of thing.
What were the kit inspections like? Tell us about that.
Well, it was an allocated time. You had to lay out all your kit on the bed, just as all services did at this stage of initial training. And you had to lay everything that you had, your boots and your spare socks and your toothbrush and your boot polishing gear and all that sort of thing, all carefully laid out in a very orderly fashion on top of a towel put on the bottom of the bed, and the boots laid on their side so that they could see whether the underside of the boots were polished and clean, and Even the studs on the bottom were polished. Ridiculous. But we, being a bit bright, I suppose, we communicated with each other, and somebody told us that the officer, if he couldn't find anything wrong with your kit layout, would uncork your water bottle and make sure that your chain and the plug for the stopper for the water bottle were not rusty, and if they were rusty, it gave them an opportunity to put you on charge for having a rusty water bottle. So we all very carefully cleaned that bit free of rust, and then somebody had a pot of Vaseline, and it all went, same pot went round to everybody, and you had to dig into this Vaseline so that you could put this on the where it got rusty, and stopped it going rusty anymore, you know, for the time being. And I remember we had done that. This chap I shared a room with, or shared perhaps a bed bunk with, we had done this, and I remember uncorking our water bottles and seemingly being absolutely furious when he discovered we'd got carefully put Vaseline on it without having been told to do so. He was unable to put us on a charge for some slight demeanour like that. Anyway, that was the standard of stupid discipline that we had to endure, and we overcame that for within the month, and that was the end of that. So we had, you know, we were very fit and very, very, still very keen.
Well, how did you take to drill, you know, the actual, you know, the repetitiveness of it? I mean, you said you were keen, but what did you think of it yourself?
I didn't find any bother. Once you'd learnt how to do it and what was expected of you, and you did it in ordinary time, quick time, slow time, and everything else, and we became, I suppose, relatively good at it in our own amateurish sort of way. But no, I didn't find it any particular bother.
Now, you'd be at that ITW, what, November, December, January, or...?
No, we got leave just before Christmas. I remember going home for the first time on leave at Christmas, and being thoroughly spoiled.
Leave from the ITW?
From the DISIP course at Cambridge, 14 days, or whatever it was, 7 days leave. And it was very, very pleasant. I was very spoilt. Revelled in having lots of baths. Bathing was always a problem throughout one's service career of any grade or any rank. To be able to get a good hot bath, and with no, you know, not having to hurry, was a great thing, and to have home cooking again was marvellous. So, but after this Christmas leave, and we were very lucky to get home actually over Christmas, obviously, we then had to report to Heaton Park in Manchester, and that was the start of a real 3 or 4 months, or whatever it was, of very boring treatment. Heaton Park was the camp, and just a series of Nissen huts and very little else. Where
it was
all
in the park.
In the park, yeah. And we marched, you know, the long way between the huts where you lived in and the huts, the place you had to go and report to for meals and so on, or for any instruction. So we were forever marching backwards and forwards, and it was always raining, of course, being Manchester. I can barely remember a day when it didn't rain sometime.
And what were you actually doing? It was
a reception centre, and it was the whole idea was that all aircrew under training went there before being sent overseas for flying training. So it was just a transit camp, and there were 7,000 or 8,000 people there at one time, and it was pretty just uncomfortable. It was wet, and it was soulless. There was you know, nothing to do there.
Did you get out and about in Manchester?
Yes. Well, luckily we were able to earn on 3 shillings a day was enough to get us into Manchester for most evenings, or parts of most evenings. And there were cinemas and dances to go to where you could meet or pick up a Mancunian little girl. And one of our immediate friends, party gang, if you like to call it that, called Alan Symington, as it happened, he met Manchester girl and became very fond of her indeed, and kept friendly with her the whole of the time we were at Heaton Park, and for quite a long time afterwards. But I think nothing came of it eventually, but still it was a very, very enduring friendship.
What about, what were the dance halls like? Because they don't have dance halls now. What do you remember of a night out at a dance hall? I mean, what was it like?
Well, I wasn't a very great dancer. I wasn't not the sort of place I would choose to go first. I would rather go to the pictures or just spend an evening drinking a pint or two in a pub, I think. But if you did go to a dance, you turned up and you paid your however many shillings it was entry fee, and you went inside, and there were hundreds and hundreds of people usually inside, and a very good dance band playing. I mean, there was a real live band usually, and there would be, you know, many hundreds there, and they played dance music and various dances, the foxtrot, the waltz, and the polka, and those sort of common ballroom dancing. I don't think.
Was it dry or was it alcohol? Was
I don't remember. I suppose it was alcohol available. I honestly don't remember that bit.
And what was the etiquette of getting people to dance, or did someone like you just not dance?
No, well, you didn't go there not to dance. You went there to try. In my case, it was trying to spot somebody who wasn't about 3 foot taller than I was, because that was embarrassing. If you did in a Paul Jones, for example, where you all circle around in opposite way in circles, and you have to stop to dance with the person that you finish up opposite, with a bit of luck, you didn't have somebody. I didn't find myself opposite a girl of six foot tall and with big bosoms, because that was embarrassing. So with a bit of luck, you escape that. But that's the way you did meet, quite by chance, usually, often, quite nice girls who just went there for to be able to dance. And you didn't, certainly, unless you hit it off particularly well with a particular girl, you didn't stick to the girl other than for the one dance. You just circulated, and if you saw a girl sitting down and the music had started, you go up to her and ask her if she'd like to dance. Sometimes she said no, and which is a bit disappointing, but nearly always they said yes. And of course it was not etiquette for the girl to go around and ask a bloke to dance. That was just not done. And quite a lot of people, like this chap Alan Symington that I previously mentioned, who was a very nice guy, he met also a very nice girl, and they danced together all through the night, and used to go to the dance, whatever it was, dance hall, several nights a week. And we did that, you know, when we could afford it.
Now, what about the pubs? What were they like? Because pubs, there's still plenty of pubs now, but things have changed there. What was the atmosphere like in a Manchester pub then for you? I mean, what did you think of it?
Well, it depended on the pub. There were some very scruffy pubs which were not so pleasant. Well, there were one or two that you could sit down in and talk and linger over your beer or shandy or whatever it was you drank. Spend the whole evening there, and all you did was have a pint or so of, I think we probably drank half pints in those days, and chat, and if you did happen to meet a local, male or female, you chatted to them as well. But it was inconsequential chat. It was only about the weather and the...
You'd be in uniform, wouldn't you?
Yeah, oh yes, rather.
What about the cinema?
Well, that was the great let out.
That was your thing,
That was the great let out. Yes, well, one went to the cinema in those days at least once a week, and there were a choice of a dozen or perhaps half a dozen cinemas in a place like as big as Manchester, and you therefore could choose the film you wanted to see. And it was a very pleasant way of spending three hours or so.
What was the most popular type of film then? I don't mean names. I mean, you can see the films on TV now, obviously. Yes. I mean, it hasn't changed.
I think you paid your money and went in, and it was not a question of choosing. You just saw the film of the week or whatever period it was there.
Would there be a programme then? Because, you know, of several films, or one or two?
Well, there were usually two films, a big film and a small film leading to pad up the time. And what did they call the second film? The second show, the minor film.
B-movie or short.
Or something like that. And there was always movie tone news. That was always a very important thing to see, because the news was good, and the government propaganda news was very carefully selected, so you only saw the good things and very few of the bad things. But you kept up to date by going to the cinema. Oh, and I forgot to mention that during the day, because there were so many of us in the camp used to put on its own cinema shows in the local cinema just outside the camp boundaries, and sometimes there was a cinema show, and sometimes the most awful, boring travel films about American films about places you'd never even heard of, and occasionally the film would break down, or there would be a big gap in the programme with these officers and so on trying to get together something to entertain us, to keep us out of mischief. And in the dry, we had amongst our gang of cadets, we had a very good pianist. And if life got really dull, we used to all shout for... let's have Julian, I think that was his name. Julian would reluctantly shamble out of the audience and go up to the piano on the stage and try to remember tunes he could play without any music. And if he played anything that we knew the words to, of course we all sang along with it, so he became an amateur entertainer. And he was very popular because he played quite well, but having to play by ear without any preparation, and when he wasn't feeling particularly like doing it, but all the shouting, and the officers used to say haul him out of the crowd, and he used to play for, let's say, half an hour, which filled in another half an hour of the boring day, and. Kept us, as I say, from getting up to other trouble.
You're heating from what? January 44, how long?
Till about, I think it must have been April.
That's a hell of a long time.
A hell of a long time. And it went on and on and on. And we rarely...
What was morale? I mean, did people get fed up?
Oh, yes, very fed up. So fed up that, for example, the great thing during the day, if we were having a series of very boring lectures or just drilling and going from one drill corporal to another, the squad would start off as 100 strong, marching to place from A to B. By the time it got to B, 50 blokes had left the squad, just quietly crept away and shinned over the wall. And as soon as you got outside the camp, you belted to as fast as you could to the Heaton Park railway station, and if you get on a train to, well, once you got on the platform, you were fairly safe. Get into Manchester and get out of the way. But the discipline.
And you did that as well, did you?
Well, not very often, because if you got caught, it was 7 or 14 days jankers. And a friend of mine did get caught, and I had a very unpleasant time doing jankers, which is that jankers was really been going on a charge, being sentenced, if you could call it that, to 7 or 14 days. I don't know what the proper name was, but jankers it was known as by the troops. And you had to report to the guardroom every hour during the evening, and so you couldn't go out anywhere, and you had to report in full kit, small pack, big pack, water bottle filled, and all that sort of nonsense. So, and the corporals in the guardroom had nothing better to do than to think up unpleasant jobs for you to do, like clean out the latrines or the wash house, and sweep up, or generally cleaning up, just unpleasant jobs which presumably had to be done, and people on jankers were the people who got caught for doing it.
So all this came to an end in April.
Yes, all this came to an end when eventually, if you're lucky enough, your name or your squad's name came up for a draft, and a draft for overseas flying training, and at long last we got put on a draft to South Africa, and we all got kitted up with khaki drill uniforms and pith helmets and all that sort of thing, and within a few days of embarking then onto a troop ship to go to South Africa, one of the chaps in my hut, a Nissen hut, I suppose a Nissen hut, slept about 12 or 14 people at a time. He got either measles or German measles, I don't know which one it was now. And so he reported sick with measles, and the whole hut got taken off the draft. We were absolutely furious. We'd been waiting all these months to go overseas, and we got taken off draft. So we had to hand back all this equipment, South African type equipment that we'd had, and hand it all back and wait for another draft. This poor chap who got measles was so unpopular and so felt so guilty, because nothing he could do about it. But then, fortunately, not too long after that, we got put on a fresh draft, and this one was to not only to Canada, but to the United States. Straight away, we were told that we were picked out with a pin, I can't think of any other reason, to go to the United States for training, and we go there via Canada. But whereas the Canadian draft got fairly inferior looking khaki drill and special uniforms to wear in Canada, because I don't think we had short trousers in Canada and the States. We had shorts to go to South Africa with, but those were not the right thing to wear in Canada or the United States. So whereas the Canadian draft got fairly inferior looking quality khaki drill, we got a superb issue of very smooth long trousers, brown shoes, a special or very smooth looking shirts, much smoother altogether than the Canadian lot. And so right from the start, we knew we were going to the States.